The topic tonight will be chaos and health or something of that nature, and this is Fritz Norstedt. I'm going to begin with something that has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about. That's to kind of tune in on chaos, I think. Maybe tangentially something from this week, and ties a bit to last night. It's from Faust, where Faust spouts off. Now I have studied philosophy, medicine, and the law, and unfortunately theology. Wearily sweating, yet I stand now, poor fool, no wiser than I was before. I am called master, even doctor, and for these last 10 years have led my students by the nose, up and down crossways and crooked. Now I see that we know nothing finally, and this burns my heart. Alas, there are two souls that live in me, and one would like to leave its brother. One with gripping organs clings to earth with a rough and hearty lust. The other rises powerfully from the dirt up toward the region of the great forefathers. If there are lordly spirits in the air roaming between the earth and sky, let them come down from the golden atmosphere and lead me to a new, more vivid life. I kind of like that one. All right, we're going to talk chaos. Hopefully, we will not accept chaos. I wouldn't want you to do that. I wouldn't want us to. Someone was suggesting here a little while ago in a conversation to come on friendly terms with chaos. We shouldn't. But to be reconciled to the fact of chaos may be extremely important if we are to survive on this planet or as a community, and not least as Christians. I think I may have seen at least my share of chaos. The days of my years have overlapped with a couple of world wars, and one of them I spent 4 years mostly in the South Pacific. Ministering to broken bodies and minds and souls of my countrymen and a few of the enemy. I was very near to an explosion on a ship one day when 7 people were so badly burned that they were almost beyond recognition as human beings, but were alive. And we took them into the little hospital ashore. And over the next 3 days, I was with these fellows as they died, one after another. It was a terrible thing trying to keep fluids in them. They didn't have any way to keep fluids in them. In the intervening years, and most recently, especially in the last 2 years, they've developed a way of culturing skin now so that if you can hold fluids in. Now, it isn't very common yet, and you don't go to your friendly neighborhood hospital and expect to have it done, but it's coming, where they can grow tissue very, very rapidly now, cultured out of your own skin. And some of the space things that are going on these days are trying to move back the chaos on this particular thing a bit by finding a way that possibly in space they can grow these things faster than they can on Earth. So bit by bit, I think, man tries to roll back the chaos. More of that later. It was a tragic thing to see these 7 fellows who burned so badly while doing their own duty and doing it well. But among the most tragic people in this incident with one man, one sailor, who is in the same compartment, in the same kitchen or galley that exploded. I don't like to sit here. That's a little better. And when the galley exploded, he was right there. He was the eighth person in the room. But he was standing in the shadow of one of the fellows, so that the blast missed him, and the spray of the flammable liquid missed him. And he managed to duck out with only minor burns. And he came to the hospital every day. And it was a harder thing to minister to him than it was to the seven who were hurt so badly. Partly because some of them were sort of out of it. Some of them were very alert and sharp. I remember talking with one of the men one day, on just the day, the middle day of the three that they lived. And he could respond just a little bit through his thick, burned lips. Asked if there was anything I could do for him. And he muttered something. And I said, let me pray. And I began with the Lord's Prayer, thinking this would be the most familiar thing to him, and it would be easier to get through the fog and the haze of the distress and the agony that he was in physically by using the very familiar. But he stopped me. He said, no, tell the others. I had learned before that this man was deeply committed young Christian gentleman, and he died like a Christian, thinking of his buddies who probably should have some attention. But his problem was, why not me? It's one way of saying the same thing that the rest of us have said from time to time when something happens to us. Why me? When people have broken legs, for instance, or broken arms, or that kind of trauma, it's one of the most common expressions. Why did this have to happen to me? Now, in some other things, people don't ask that kind of question. Heart attacks, they don't ask that. They say, more like, I must have done something. There's a guilt factor that tends to get express itself in the coronaries. But with fractures, they say, why me? Now, there may be some reason for that, because fractures come as a result of accidents, right? Very few people go out and just break their bones on purpose, but so that they are accidents. And yet you have to qualify that a bit, because devout Christians break more bones than non-devout Christians. Watch it. And this has been pretty well documented. Now, by devout, I have to. I'm just getting your attention. The people who answered a questionnaire on one of the studies that Flander Dunbar did a number of years ago, the question was, well, a whole bunch of questions, but one of them was, how would you characterize your religious background? And the people who underlined the words like devout or strict were the ones who were breaking the bones. Now, not exclusively, but there was a very significant difference in the strict religious backgrounds as over against those who did not characterize their religious backgrounds as strict. I don't think it's too hard to figure that one out, because the people who live under legalistic religious stress tend to walk differently than others do. Well, the person that says, I know my Lord, I know that my Redeemer lives, doesn't walk stiff-legged and uncertain. And he isn't so apt to miss the top step and then go subsequently. He isn't apt to walk out in the middle of the street and say, oh, I should have been doing this. He lives under a kind of a compulsion of doing right. And this gets reflected in muscle tone. So be careful. Get the gospel straight if you want to keep your bones intact. Now, you can't, obviously, you can't make this as any kind of an absolute. I hope not, because I've broken bones twice. I don't think that I would underline strict or devout in the usual popular way in which that might be used to characterize my faith. I'm the kind of a guy, I suppose, that long ago learned that one of the things Christians have to learn to do is to be able to say with a whole heart, to hell with it. And if a Christian can't do that, who in the world can? Is it appropriate for anybody else to say it? We know what we're talking about. It'd be nice if we had some special oil made to relax our joints a bit, so that if we do tend to get a little bit too rigid or too strict, too compulsive, too much possessed by the problem of doing the will of God, if we do that, we ought to find some state-of-the-art oil that can relax us, you know, in our muscles and our joints and things. It's a dreadful thing to live out your days being obsessed with a concern with whether or not you're doing the will of God. Now, this may offend you a bit, because I know a lot of us would like to be obsessed with that, but don't even try to make this a daily characteristic of your life. I've got to find out today what God wants me to do. God, for the most part, wants you to do what you want to do. I'm talking now about you as a Christian, and one who has been confronted by the gospel and has accepted it. And then you don't have to live under this dreadful fear that you may or may not, that you may not be living within the strict guidelines of the will of God. So be careful for your bones, huh? But coming back now, these fellows, here they were. Seven of them dead, one of them living. And it took a long, long time to get this man to any kind of peace whatsoever. This one that survived, because he was racked by the question, why was I the one to escape? Now, there's something of love in his concern, right? If it hadn't been for love, probably he would have said, no, that's the way the cookie crumbles or something. But he was deeply concerned and grieving over the death of these buddies with whom he had worked every day for maybe a year or two in the close confines of a galley on a small ship. Oh, there were so many. I saw lines of people killed, and it's almost like every third one is going to be dead and two-thirds live. Why those particular ones? It's an easy answer and a tempting one to think as a Christian now. Well, God has some reason on this. And that, if you're far enough away from it, it's easy enough to come to that and say, well, God must have some purpose in saving these two and letting this one be killed, and saving these two and letting this one be killed. It's a little bit harder to do that if it's your daughter that you saw born. And she grows up a strong, strong desire to be a good Christian mother and have some babies and to have a Christian home, to be a mother like her mother was, and then to see just when she was had the stage set for being a Christian mother, to find that a dreadful cancer has invaded and she was never going to be this mother. But she lived through it courageously and taught us a lot in the living and in the dying. She had a sense of humor that some of us had a hard time mustering up. She was treated by some of these drugs that are such blessings but have, you know, such a bad sound today in some of the cytotoxic substances. They call it chemotherapy, but man, I'll have to watch out for that word because I have to take some aspirin for my arthritis, but I'm not under chemotherapy. It's dreadful, wiggly words, you know, that strike such terror to people. And chemotherapy is one of the great blessings of our day, not only an aspirin for somebody's minor arthritis, but all kinds of ways in which these drugs are used to relieve suffering and to cure disease. So don't let the word make it sound so dreadful that if the time comes you have to go on some chemotherapy for cancer or for something else that you die of fright. A little bit better to die of the cancer perhaps. But anyway, Sue, well, they let her come home from the hospital once in between. Well, every once in a while they let her come home in between these treatments that really racked her up, created an ulcer that went from her mouth and all through the whole gastrointestinal tract, and it was a dreadful thing. She had to use tongue blades to hold her beautiful lips up because they were no longer beautiful and they all swollen up and ulcerated. But somehow or another, when tissue straightened, calmed down for a little while, then it was necessary for her to laugh a bit. And very important. And she had learned to laugh at death, and man alive, you can laugh at anything after you've learned to laugh at death. Well, one night she was home for 2 or 3 days and she was lying on a little sofa in her family room, and she said, "You know what I'd like to have? I would like to have a mama burger." So I said, "Sue, I'll go right out and get it." And she said, "No, I want to go." "Sue, you better not. You know, your platelets are way down and man alive. If I should put on a brace kind of fast and you bump your head, you could bleed to death." She laughed and said, "What a way to go. Go on for a mama burger." Now, which put things in perspective a bit, huh? By that time, she and everybody else knew she was dying, and it wouldn't have been a bad way to depart from this life, huh? Certainly better than dying in some sterile room in a hospital among strangers. She kicked us all out of her room one time. Her mother, her pastor husband, and her pastor father. She got really angry with us and sat up in bed, and that took a little doing. And this was in the hospital, and she said, "Get out of here and stay out of here. Don't come back until you're reconciled to your own deaths. And then we've got something to talk about." Well, her mother got back first, and her husband got back second, and her theological professor father came in a 4/3. But I didn't dare to face those blazing eyes. Well, the others didn't either. It just took me longer to work through that. But why Susan? I had to ask him one night, why Susan? Of all the people in this world, why? Well, it's a senseless question in the kind of, huh? But I knew that one night when I had to make the decision and had been left to me, should we feed her or not feed her? If we don't feed her, she dies tonight or tomorrow. And it's not easy to make that kind of a decision. And but the thing that made it necessary to make the decision was that the cancer had now started to travel up into the brain, and she was showing the paralysis from it. And with all of the possibilities, if she lived another week, this could be infiltrating parts of the brain that would make the pain tractable. And it's a little hard to face someone you love if you've done that to them too. I took a walk around the block, and my anger was pouring out. I had the experience of shaking my fist and saying, "Damn you, God, why did you do it?" And then stopping and almost chuckling. What was I asking? Was I asking if he did this? Does God, is he the Lord of cancer? Did he choose Sue? And you know, millions of others. It's just that when it comes closer home, the questions get asked in a little different way. Why do the righteous suffer? That's one way of saying it. Why does anybody suffer? Why this one and not that one, or whatever? Why do good things happen to what appear to be bad people, and why do bad things happen to what appears to be good people? Because it happens every day. Look around you. I was in a little shack town thing down in Costa Rica a few years ago, with a horrible place. It's one of these things that comes into existence in so many places in this world, kind of overnight, when people try to squat on some land and put together a bunch of patent grapes and tins and things and try to make a place to live. There was nothing like a toilet, latrine in the whole place. There was one little garden hose that took care of the water supply for it turned out to be 840-some people. And then to see the mothers stand and drive their little girls out of the village at night, it was estimated that somewhere around 80% to 90% of all the girls that were in the village, over 12, were prostitutes. And it was the only way that the mothers could support their families. The fathers had long since gone some other place. Many times in just outright desertion, and sometimes trying to find some work that they could, so they could send something back. Now, why this bunch of people? They called their town Aguantafilo, which I understand means holds your hunger, and it came about when some politician pulled his sound truck up outside this little place. And he was squawking loud through the loudspeaker, saying, "If you elect me, I'll see to it that your children go to good schools." And the mother shouted out, "But our kids are hungry today, feed us. You vote for me, and I'll see to it that there's food. We'll remember you. But it's today we're hungry." And every time he said something, he'd call back and heckle. "It's food today." And finally, he blew his top and shouted out at them, "But want to feel it. Hold your hunger. Stuff it." And he drove off. And the mothers picked this up as the name of their village. Why that bunch? And not some other bunch. Why the little girl who lived in our community a block and a half from us? Beautiful, beautiful little kid. I remember her running home. It was just such a joy to see this little cherub come running home from school 3 o'clock in the afternoon or so, with her reddish gold hair and bouncing curls, as she had come running joyfully home. She got to the corner down a block from us. And Joe, who had been drinking too much and had a problem with alcohol anyway, long standing, had been over at the bar just long enough to get soused just enough so that he could manipulate the car to that corner at the exact moment that this little girl was stepping out of the curb. And he made garbage out of her. She was just a pulp. And I found the question coming into sharper focus for me that day when I tried to go down and meet the parents and ask if there was anything I could do. I think all the other neighbors asked the same question, but maybe I was asking it in a little different setting because I was a pastor and I had no idea people what their religious background was or affiliations, and all I knew was that no pastor had been there yet. This is only a little while after the girl had been crushed. Just squashed. Ugly. Vulgar. It's hard to erase the memory of that little tyke lying there. Walked in to see the parents. Put my arms around them. They were strangers to me. I just seen them a little bit, like you see people a little block from me. City. But I put my arms around them and told them how sorry I was. And they said, oh, don't be sorry. Don't be sorry. This is God's will. Don't be sorry. This is the way God wants it. And they smiled. And after about 20 minutes, I left in a profound agony. Because there was something terribly wrong here. That somehow or another these people were believing that God did this to their little girl. That God got Joe just drunk enough to manage to pull off this feat. So she could fulfill some kind of a purpose, they thought, in God's mind. And I went away from that spot with things that I suppose I had believed or thought before, but now in sharper focus. What have we done? What has prompted the distortions that make it so easy for us to see in every lousy, rotten, dirty thing that happens on this planet, some intent of God or some purpose? I can understand a little bit that it's easier to try to think that, huh? I'm not sure that I didn't do it a good deal during Sue's sickness and at the time we're dying and her death. It would have been, in some ways, an easy first comfort to have said, well, he's got some purpose in this. But to say that that's what caused it in the first place, that is to introduce a Lord that I do not know. Now let me pronounce the word, chaos, huh? There is chaos in existence. And in some way that I don't understand, God has limited his power so that chaos exists. And I think it has something to do with our creation in the first place, and something to do with the freedom that he gave to us, and something to do with the fall of man into sin. Somehow or another, chaos got introduced into Eden and into paradise. I can accept that hand of a loving God who reaches down into my chaos and holds me. I'd have a harder time if I thought he caused it in the first place. God reaches into our agonies, into the chaos, holds us, heals us, lifts us up. But it's a chaos that is not of his causing. I would rather live believing in chaos, in the concept of chaos. Without it, I would go insane. I don't know how I could live. The years of my life have seen more of it than I would like to see, because of military service and then spending most of my time in hospitals throughout most of my life. So I've been lopsidedly exposed to agony and to chaos. Now, I think because I cannot believe that this comes out of the hand of God, that God's hands are used for other things in causing this. God's hands are used to wrap around us and to hold us and to lift us out. I think because of that, I think I laugh about as much as anybody that I know. Not simply by contrast or relief, but because from my mother's arms I've learned that God reaches in to these agonies and heals us and saves us. I suppose it's from there that some of us like to make the easy jump and say, well, God caused it in the first place in order that this might happen. That's quite a different thing, isn't it? I don't know how many of you know Peter DeVries. He's a cynical guy. Most of the stuff that he's written I thoroughly enjoy because I like pens and vinegar in the ink. Once in a while it's kind of fun to read somebody with a sharp and Peter DeVries and tripping into some of the bubbles. But he's kind of cynical. But he wrote a book that I picked up and couldn't believe that it was the same Peter DeVries, because the name of the book was The Blood of the Lamb. And I thought, how could Peter DeVries write a book under the title The Blood of the Lamb? And besides that, I thought this is a kind of a, if you'll excuse me, a corny title for a book anyway. It's kind of an overused. I thought he was writing a Sunday school book and not Peter DeVries. Well, he, in this book, he's more, I think autobiographical. But he comes out of a Dutch Reformed background, and he really takes some cracks at the rigidities that he had lived under in his Dutch Reformed home. But this is a novel kind of thing. Supposedly, it has nothing to do with Peter DeVries. I don't believe it. I don't care what he says. I don't believe it. This guy had been at the point of suffering and has seen it so intimately that he can write what he wrote in The Blood of the Lamb, because it goes on through a whole bunch of stuff. Some of the garbage of his life and or of a life, the life of the central figure in this book. And then it comes to his daughter. And he's got a delightful little daughter. And the central figure, whether it's degrees or not, I don't know. He's divorced, and so he has the sole custody of this little child. And a delightful little girl, age 11 or 12, no, 10 or 11. And she's a pure delight, happy, blithe spirit. And then some things show up that don't look so good, and you take her to the doctor, and a dreadful diagnosis is made that she has leukemia. Well, it rocks the father, who's a tender, loving kind of a guy, with the one great joy of his life, this little daughter. And she goes on through so many leukemics that had to go through. And he suffers along with her and rejoices every time she's in remission and can come home for a while. And he decides that after a while, knowing that this isn't going to go on very much longer, he decides that he's going to let her do some things that, and normally you don't let your little 10 or 11 year old daughter do. So he lets her date, and she's got a charming little boyfriend. And they go out, and he lets them stay out late at night. They go to shows, and they have become hooked on slapstick comedy, the pie in the face kind of stuff, you know. And they come home one night from a show, kind of late. The old man's still sitting up, pretending that he wasn't sitting up just because she was still out, this little darling. But he knows she's going to miss out on a lot of things, and he wants her to have some of it now, some of the joy of knowing some boy and finding that little thrill that goes when you touch hands. What is that? I've never been able to figure that out. I can touch. But there have been a few people in my life where little fingers just touch, you know, something happens all over. Have any of you ever experienced it? All right. And he wanted her to experience a little bit of that. So they come in the house, holding hands and swinging their hands. And, oh, Dad, she said, you should have seen what we saw tonight. The classical pie in the face. Absolute. Well, so he said, what's this? Well, classical pie in the face. It's got to be done just right. There's a way. You see a lot of poor pie in the face, she explained. But this is done beautifully. Now, this is the way you do it. First, you have to have a gooey pie. It's no sense in doing this with, you know, something else. It's got to be gooey. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Then you put it in somebody's hand like this. It's always got to be, and it stays back here until everybody that's seeing this realizes that the guy is now getting an uncontrollable urge to push it. Smack at somebody's face. And when this happens, it's done in a sort of a slow motion. It can't be just flipped. It could never be done carelessly, she explains. Never. This has to be pushed. And then it always flies, and it doesn't just bounce off somebody's ear. Now, it's got to hit full face, waffle, right on. Then you watch. For a moment, nothing happens. It stays there. Then it starts to slide. And she's telling all this. It starts to slide, and it comes down, and it comes down, and it goes plop. Then the right hand comes over, and the index finger goes into the eye. Sorry. Cleans that one out. And the index finger on the other hand goes over. Now that's classical pie in the face. But just a few days after this interesting evening, in which the father was so happy along with the little girl, that there was a moment of just unadulterated happiness, joy. But then she had to go back into the hospital. And a week later, her birthday was coming along. So I guess Mrs. Brodheim, cook and housekeeper type, to make a good birthday cake. A really nice one. It had to be big enough because in the ward there were 12 other children with leukemia. And she had to have a birthday party to end all birthday parties. This would be her last birthday party, probably. So Mrs. Brodheim, make this a good one. You know, you've done nice ones before, but now really. And lots of thick, nice frosting on it. The next morning, he hurried to the hospital to start the day off, her birthday, with the happiness of a birthday party. And this birthday cake, and hopefully all the kids can come in and, you know, have this cake. As soon as he gets on the floor, he realizes something is wrong, and the nurses say, no, don't go in there quite yet. It'll be a little while. And he realizes that he has arrived with the cake just a bit too late. He's got this damn thing in his hands. But he walks into the room holding it. And he looks at her and realizes that now the suffering is over and this end has come. That doesn't make it much easier, even though he's been knowing it's going to come. It doesn't make it much easier. But now it is. It's right there. It's this palpable reality. He picks up her hands and looks at some of her arms and sees the stigmata where 100 needles have pierced and insulted this tissue. And finally, he honks and blows his nose and dashes out of the place. Still holding the cake. And he goes down and heads down the street and not knowing where he's going, but stumbling into people, having cars toot at him because he's crossing the street against traffic. Doesn't hear any of it. He's numb. But he walks past a church, a big, fine cathedral. So he thinks, maybe here. So he makes a left turn and he goes up the steps. Walks in under the beautiful entranceway, which is a big mosaic, with the Christ hanging on the cross. He goes down the altar, down the long aisle to the altar, and still holding this crazy cake. Kneels down there and tries to get the ear of God, but somehow or another doesn't seem to be getting through. So he stumbles back out of there. And he gets out on the street and he makes another left turn and goes on further. He heads for Joe's bar, which probably was his intent in the first place, unconscious intent. So he goes down there and he says, make it a double. Well, Joe thinks it's kind of early in the morning for doubles. But he tosses that one down and says, another one. And after about the fourth double, Joe says, hey, no more, buddy, no more for you. You've had too much. I don't know how you can still sit up after swallowing all of that this fast. So he stumbles out of the bar, hardly feeling the alcohol, obsessed with the pain and the agony. The despair of all of this. And he starts down the street, not knowing why or where he's going to head, but he starts back, retracing his steps. And just as he's passing the church, he remembers the cake. So he goes up, and sure enough, there's the cake sitting there, right below the altar, where he put it, as though it were some offering of some kind, but done in unconsciousness. So he picks it up, not knowing why, and he walks out. And when he gets out to the end of the long aisle and goes out through the narthex, and he opens the big oak doors, still hanging, protecting this cake, he And the fresh air hits it, and all of a sudden, so is the alcohol. So he sits down and leans back against the oak doors. And pretty soon he looks up. And now he knows what he's going to do with the cake. And he's been instructed well by the little girl. So it goes into his hand. And he gives it that slow motion shove, but a powerful enough one to carry up there. And it hit the mark right straight in his face. And then alcohol, hope, what was it? A hand comes off the nails. And he, after all his gook is done, it's sagging and it's plopping down. And it comes out of one eye, goes back to the nails, comes off the nails. All through this again. And then he hears, out of the distant past, out of what may have been a too rigid family religious background, but nonetheless, the gospel coming through. Suffer the little children, your little child, to come unto me. So he stands up and walks down the street. DeVries puts a little footnote on the end of this and says, this is the only alternative to suicide. Well, anybody who's been through these things can tune in on what DeVries is talking about here. Even the comedy of it. Throw the pie in his face and hear him say, I love you. Out of the depths, huh? We cry, Lord, hear my voice. Do it with a pie if you have to. Shake your fist and say, damn you, God. But just be real about it, out of this agony. And somehow or other, the chaos loses its terror. And life becomes not only bearable, goodness sakes, God forbid that we should live through life just bearing it, but celebrating it. God doesn't cause leukemia, but he sure reaches down to hold us, doesn't he? To hold us very close. Let him do it. But you won't be able to let him do it unless you eyeball chaos. And hate it for what it is. But find out of the agony and out of the depths that God stands ready to redeem and ready to heal. Ah, then death is swallowed up in victory, huh? Then you can spit in the eye, even of death, and say to Yahweh, now some of you in this room are living very close to this sort of thing right now, I know. Learn to spit in the face a little bit. And if it's a little hard, just reach up. And in whatever way is easy for you to hold his hand, just discover it's there. and he lifts. And then you can celebrate. With a shocking thing in our home one night,
the night Sue died,
the doctor who had worked so hard and so sincerely and so compassionately to try to save her had to be called out to do an autopsy, which needed to be done, and needed to be done just in the shortest possible time after death. So we had given him advance warning that it was probably going to be in a few hours, and then called him just when death took place. And well, by the way, she died when she had a long record. I should tell you about that for a minute. She had a long tape that she had us make earlier in her illness with all of the things that she would like to listen to. Her wedding music, for instance, was in there. The dear, close friends who sang her favorite things at the wedding. And then a hymn that had some special meaning to her and had since childhood. That Christmas, right. The last verse, "Be with me, Lord Jesus, I ask thee to stay. Close by me forever, and love me, I pray. If all the dear children in thy tender care bring us to heaven to live with you there." She had hummed this and said it when she was going into surgery a couple of times. And she wrote it in a baby book for her little adopted son. Remember this one? And when the time of death came, where it seemed like her breathing was getting harder, we went and somebody said, "Let's turn on the tape for her," because she'd been listening to this every night after we had taken her out of the hospital. And that's the way she'd gone to sleep. And that night she just went to sleep during that same hymn, which was the last thing on the record. That's when her breathing stopped. So then we went out in the kitchen and had coffee, and somebody thought it was time for the doxology. And did we sing? No tears, they came later, copiously. The doctor walked into this after a while and couldn't believe what he was singing. Told us later when he got better acquainted with it. But sure, you people were absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. But he hadn't quite known about this hand that reaches into death to lift us and to hold us and to heal us. Okay, let's leave.